Hi, everybody. This is Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today I have Rabbi Natan Slifkin, a very, very important rabbi and a very famous rabbi who has written a beautiful article in the Jewish Action for the fall 2013. Rabbi Slifkin, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, that's good. Now, I know many people call you the Zoo Rabbi. Is that an appropriate title?
Yeah. I'm not involved with the Zoo of Jerusalem as I used to be, but I am dealing very much with zoology and the relationship between zoology and Judaism. So I guess in that sense, Zoo Rabbi is an appropriate moniker.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure whether it was the term that you felt was appropriate. I read the article that you wrote. It was extremely interesting, and I had to read it twice, I'll be honest with you, because I wasn't quite sure at first what the purpose of the article was. So maybe you could tell. It's about hawking, and it's not about selling wares. It's about a different kind of hawking. So why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the article and why you wrote it?
Well, it starts off by trying to understand why some of the Rishonim, some of the great medieval Torah scholars, made some comments about hawking, notably in explaining how Yaakov tried to appease Esav, and it was suggested by Rabbeinu Tam that Yaakov tried to appease Esav by giving him a hawk, which seems to be a strange comment, a strange thing to say. But if we learn about the role that hawking played amongst medieval Jews, especially amongst figures such as Rabbeinu Tam, then we can understand why it was on his mind and why he decided to use that in his interpretation of the Torah.
Right, and you also differentiate clearly between the falcon and the hawk, saying that it would be highly unlikely, according to Rabbeinu Tam for sure, that he would have given Esav the falcon, correct?
Yeah, it would have been the hawk, which is a more prestigious bird. But the truth is, it's confusing because the sport of hunting with birds of prey is called falconry, but the verb describing the act of hunting is called hawking. So you can do falconry with hawks, and you can go hawking with falcons.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Very interesting. Now, I know you cover an interesting subject in the article. You talk a little bit about the concept of hunting, which we certainly, I don't think, associate Rabbeinu Tam or other people. You mentioned several other people. We certainly don't associate them with going out into the woods and kind of, hunting. So how do you explain that?
Well, there's a few angles here. First is that hunting, in terms of hunting animals with a bow and arrow or with dogs and so on, is certainly not traditionally a Jewish thing. Many great halachic authorities have spoken out against hunting, notably the Noda Bihuda. Falconry appears to be in somewhat of a different category. It's not clear exactly why, but as explained in the article, falconry was more the equivalent of, kind of the equivalent of golf today. It was something that was practiced by the nobility, and it was something that if you were an important position in the Jewish community, as Rabbeinu Tam was, and you had to rub shoulders with the kings and the noblemen. So today you'd go golfing with them. Back then you'd go hawking with them, and I think it gives us an interesting insight into Rabbeinu Tam, that he wasn't just a scholar sitting in the Beis HaMedrash, but he was somebody who was involved in politics and, as part of that, involved in hawking.
Well, I mean, that's quite a revelation. Most people assume he's like sitting, with the pen or the quill, writing his Sfarim all day long. And, now we seem to think he has more of a social, political lifestyle, correct?
That's correct. But it also seems that sometimes he would be also doing it for food, because what we find in the Shittim HaKubetzet is it's writing the tradition that Rabbeinu Tam would put these silver fingernails on the talons of his hawk so that when the hawk caught the food, it wouldn't puncture it, which would make the pheasant non-kosher for eating. So Rabbeinu Tam clearly was sometimes eating the pheasants or whatever his hawks were catching, and that's why he was putting these silver fingernails on his talons.
So now, what did they do with the silver fingernails? How did that stop it from becoming a treif bird?
It has to do with, even today, when naturalists sometimes will use hawks to catch birds, and they don't want the hawk to kill it, just to hold it in place. So they put beads on the talons of the hawk, so that the, you know, 'cause the talons are extremely sharp. That's why if you look at the pictures of me going hawking, you'll see I'm wearing a very, very thick glove. Because even if the hawk, you know, the hawk isn't trying to hurt you, but just the grip is so immensely strong that with the sharp talons, it will puncture your skin. So if you don't want the hawk to do that, you'll put beads or some kind of covering over the edge of the talons so that it will just hold the prey firmly in place, but without puncturing it.
No, that's still a pretty. I know you went. You know, from England, and then you went back to your native land, and you went hawking. And but is that done a lot? Is that done in America? Are there places in America where they do it?
It is. It's not so popular in America. I do know of a few places they do it. It's not, it's certainly not as big as it is in England. In England, it's extremely popular. It always has been. In the Middle East, it's very popular in the Arab countries, and as a result, in Israel, it's illegal because, you know, there's a big problem of birds of prey, many of which are endangered. And in Arab countries, you know, they catch them from the wild to use them for hawking, and they're often treated very badly. So Israel are very worried about that happening, so hawking is illegal in Israel.
So what is actually the difference between a hawk and a falcon? I mean, they're quite similar, right?
They're similar. They're both raptors, birds of prey. Hawks are just quite a bit bigger.
Uh-huh. The hawk is bigger than the falcon. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so what actually happens? You go into the woods, you send them out, and they wait on top of a tree someplace and then wait for a rabbit or a pheasant to run by, and then they just swoop down and catch them?
Well, it's a cooperative venture. I mean, the way I did it was you find a likely spot, you cast off the hawk so it flies off into a nearby tree, and then you beat around the bush with a stick to flush out whatever might be hiding there, a rabbit or a pheasant, and if something comes out, the hawk will dart down and catch it.
So there you go with another expression. I was interesting in your article. You said that the term "fed up" is one which we could associate with this. So maybe you could explain that.
Yeah, that's where the expression "being fed up" comes from. You know, to get a hawk to perform, it will only hunt for you if it's hungry. So falconers, you know, they weigh their hawks and falcons, and to determine if it's hungry enough to actually perform properly. If it's had too much to eat, then it's fed up. And it won't cooperate. That's where the phrase "being fed up" comes from.
And then what about beat around the bushes? You just said that. That's another.
That I don't know. I haven't investigated the origins of that phrase.
Okay, so maybe another article will deal with beat around the bushes, mm-hmm. how that has some biblical reference to it. I thought it was very fascinating, though, because you take a part of the Chumash, which everybody knows, and you deal with it, and you deal with it in a different way. I mean, it's a very unique style that you have, and I really think most people really find it fascinating.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to, in general, in my studies and teachings about animals of the Torah, it's really bringing to light the fact that the Nevi'im and the Chacham and the Chazal, they lived in a world of nature, and they drew upon examples from animals and birds when they wanted to teach messages. And if we're going to understand the lessons they're trying to teach, we have to learn more about the animals and the landscape in which they were speaking about.
So how do you go about doing all your research on this?
Well, I have a lot of books, all the books that have ever been written on animals of the Torah the last couple of hundred years. And in terms of identifying the animals, so there's a lot of research there, and you have to realize that the animals of the Torah are the animals of Israel, which are not the same as the animals of Europe and North America. And then in terms of understanding the symbolism in which they use in the Torah, then it's a matter of, you know, studying zoology and trying to figure out why the animal is being used in that way.
So give us an example of some things that you're working on now. Are you always working on new projects? I know that.
Yeah. Well, right now I just finished writing the first volume of a Torah encyclopedia of the animal kingdom, in which I go through every single reference to animals in Tanakh, in the Gemara, and the Midrash. So I just finished volume one, which is on chayot and wild animals. So the last chapter I wrote, which is actually the first chapter in the book, is on lions, which is the most prominent animal in the Torah. mentioned over 150 times. And here's an example of something interesting. When in Tanakh, when it speaks about lions attacking, it always speaks about a male lion hiding in ambush and doing a surprise attack. Whereas if you look at books on lion behavior, they speak about how it's the females that do the hunting, and via a cooperative group stalking their prey and doing a chase through the savannah. So, you know, I had this question that the Torah speaks about attacks being done by male lions as a surprise ambush, whereas the zoology books speak about lion attack, speak about the females doing all the work via cooperative hunting and stalking and chasing through the savannah. So, literally, the day I was tackling this, a news report appeared that zoologists had discovered that, in fact, their picture they had of lion behavior was wrong. But the reason why they always thought it was the females hunting in this way is that those are the ones that were easiest to study. Because if you're going to watch animals out in the open savanna, so that's what you'll see. But then when they started attaching GPS transmitters to male lions, they saw that the male lions are also doing a lot of hunting, but in a different way. They're not doing it in the open savanna, because male lions can't run very fast. Instead, they're hunting via ambushing in the thickets, in the forest. And you have to realize that Israel, Eretz Israel, in the times of the Torah, was very heavily forested, much more so than today. So when the Torah is describing male lions hunting by ambush, it's because that's how it was back then. It was the male lions hunting, being able to hide in the thickets. And that's in contrast to what was easiest for zoologists to observe today, which was females chasing down their prey on the savannah.
Unbelievable. Amazing. Unbelievable. And what other kind of things are you working on? And I know that you have some of your books. I've read your articles. Is there anybody else, by the way, who really does what you do? You seem to be rather unique.
Well, in Israel, there's a colleague and teacher of mine, Professor Zohar Amar. He's working with Israelis. He teaches in Bar-Ilan academic courses in this topic, and he's published some wonderful material. There's my friend Ari Zivotofsky working on Kashrut angles. But in terms of the identification and symbolism in the English-speaking world, it's a pretty unusual field to be involved in. My next big project that I'm starting, I'm developing a Jewish Museum of Natural History. The idea is to have all the animals from the Tanakh and from the Gemara and the Midrash with taxidermy, stuffed animals for the larger ones and live exhibits for the smaller animals. Basically an outgrowth of the very large collection that I have at home in my basement, which my wife would very much like to see me take out of the house. The idea is to develop it into a proper museum in Bet Shemesh for people to be able to come and really learn a lot about the different animals in the Torah. And it's a real hands-on experience.
So the kids from school will come also for class trips and so on,
definitely,
right?
Definitely, but also aimed at adults.
So this is going to be a private museum in Beit Shemesh.
Yeah, that's the idea. You know, Beit Shemesh is a city which so far does not have any attractions and has been in the news for some not so positive things. So the idea is to make something that's an attraction.
Right. They do have attractions. Yeah. Unfortunately, they haven't been that positive, but this will be a good thing.
The idea is to build something positive that's of appeal to all sectors of the population, and that will be something really unique.
Now, you think every part of Israel, all the different factions will come to it, or you think there'll be some politics once again because of, you know, different situations?
I would hope so. You know, I think it has universal appeal, the idea of the animals of the Torah, and I think it's fascinating for everyone to learn about what the animals' life used to be like in Israel. And today, there's not much left. I have some foxes I sometimes see next to my house, but going back a couple of thousand years in the times of the Torah, so there were lions, bears, leopards, crocodiles, hippopotamus, a whole range of exotic wildlife that used to live here.
What is the most prevalent species of animals in Israel today?
Today, I think it would have to be the cat.
Cat, okay. What about out in the open field? I mean, you don't have deer, do you?
Well, in the Torah, there's a very prominent mention of deer and gazelles. The deer were hunted to extinction in the early 20th century, but since then there's been a very successful restoration project. The type of deer that used to live in Israel, the Ayal of the Torah, is the Mesopotamian fallow deer, And in the 1970s, there were only a few left in Iran. And the Nature Reserves Authority in Israel actually cut a deal with Iran that in exchange for the Crown Prince of Iran being allowed to hunt an ibex, a type of wild goat, in En Gedi, Israel would be able to get some Mesopotamian fallow deer. So the trade was successful, and Israel was able to bring four Mesopotamian fallow deer, and they've reproduced very successfully. And now they've been there's a program to release them back into the wild.
Great. It's interesting. Very interesting. Well, listen, Rabbi Sliskin, it's always interesting speaking to you. I encourage our listeners to read the article. They're going to find something out that Hawking is not just selling things below 99 cents, as they do in the States, you know, these stores and 99-cent stores. And Hawking was actually a sport that was probably partaken of by Gedolei Torah, something that probably no one else ever knew. And now we have a new shot on the whole idea of what Yaakov actually had it in his hand when he gave it to Esav. So you've enlightened us, you've enriched us, and once again, you know, you've brought the Torah, you know, to everybody in a way that probably we never saw it. So we thank you once again. Thank you so much for writing the article, and Hatzlacha and everything you do.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure speaking with you.